Hello and welcome to the Journalism.co.uk podcast, a show where we bring you insights from media industry experts to help journalists do their jobs better. I'm your host, Jacob Granger. This week, we've got a really fascinating story about overcoming rejection and setbacks to share with you. 12 years ago, Laura Bartlett appeared on the TV show Dragon's Den to pitch her magazine publication to a panel of mega entrepreneurs in the hope of securing investment and scaling the business. But she was turned away. The investors not sold on the quality, valuation, and overall direction of the magazine. She may have walked away without investment, but she did walk away with valuable lessons. Lessons that she's now put to good use as she's gone on to relaunch and now sell her lifestyle and tourism magazine, House of Coco, setting her up for life. Laura joins us today to reveal how she took their feedback on board and then used it to turn her fortunes around. Don't go anywhere. A big thanks to Memberful for sponsoring today's episode, the all-in-one membership solution for journalists and independent publishers. Now, it is so important these days to build loyal relationships with your readers and diversify your revenue streams. Memberful helps you to do exactly that with a range of different payment tiers and exclusive content options at your fingertips. Plus, it will integrate easily with all the tools you already use, like WordPress, MailChimp, Google Analytics and Discord, so you can start monetizing your content without changing your existing workflow. Focus on telling great stories and let Memberful handle the rest. Visit memberful.com, that's memberful.com/journalismpod to get started for free. Laura, welcome to the journalism.co.uk podcast. A pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for coming on.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Laura, I've watched a lot of Dragon's Den in my life, but very much the idea is that business owners like yourself come on the show and pitch their business to a panel of wealthy and well-connected business investors like Peter Jones, like Deborah Meaden, to, you know, hopefully use their money and their resources and their contacts to help scale the business. And this is something you did, what, 12 years ago at this point, Laura?
Yeah, so 12 years, although it feels like a different lifetime.
It does. Take me back 12 years, if you would. Why did you go on the show and what was your experience like?
At the time, I had just founded a magazine called Urban Coco, and it was a Leeds fashion magazine, and it was all about events and fashion in the city. And I'd been doing that for about a year. And then I thought, what's the obvious next step after Leeds is obviously take over the world. And I didn't think that I could do that by myself. And that's when I applied to go on Dragon's Den. Never in a million years did I think I would get on. So I applied and then I got contacted by the producers. And then I spent months with the producers filming and kind of due diligence and them just finding out everything about me. And then I got told that I was in fact going on the show. And so in my head, I'd already made it. I'm like, I'm going on Dragon's Den. The producers told me that I'm amazing, that the dragons are going to love me. And so when I went into the den, and the question that most people ask is, do you meet the dragons before the den? No. So the first time you meet them is the first time you see it on the show. And you kind of walk into this vast space with 20 camera crew, with all these lights all over you. I was really hot and sweaty. I'd spent hours filming B-roll in the morning. And then the dragons were kind of not loving me, which is not what the producers had told me. And I just wasn't mentally prepared for it. You know, I was early 20s. I was so young. And Peter Jones at the time owned Wonderland magazine, which I thought would work in my favor. But he pretty much just said, you know, quit now. It's never going to work. And then you get in the lift that doesn't even move and you kind of go home with your tail between your legs and then have to wait a few months to find out if your episode will air. And obviously it did. So when it came out, I had 6 months between filming and airing. So in that 6 months, I just worked really hard and got a distribution company on board, sold loads of advertising. And in that time, I'd actually done the thing that I'd asked for investment for, which was launch my magazine all over the world. And it came out the same weekend that Dragon's Den aired. And so it sold out globally in 60 countries. So it felt like I'd proved the dragons wrong. And that was like a really fun year, loads of opportunities on the back of the show. And one of the opportunities was to partner with The Clothes Show, which back in the day was like the big televised fashion event on the BBC. And my magazine, Elle and Cosmo, were the media partner. So I put all my eggs in one basket, thinking I was going to make all this money. And I made £5. So my company went into liquidation and I got made bankrupt. So technically the dragons were right. I did fail at that business. But then the following year, I kind of dusted myself off and decided to start again. And that's when House of Coco was born. But this time my plan was to focus on travel, to create a team where ultimately, my vision was that I would own a magazine that would allow me and my team to have amazing experiences all over the world, whilst also inspiring our readers to step outside their comfort zone and to go and travel. And basically, for 10 years, that's what we've been doing.
Right. Okay. So there's a fair amount to process there. So the the publication you took on Dragon's Den, just for clarity, was Urban Coco Magazine. You
know, yep.
As you explained there, that one didn't really materialize in the end, didn't really last. But then with the hindsights that you learned, you then launched House of Coco, which is what you've been doing for the last 10 years up until your most recent announcement that you've exited the business. That's the gist of it, right?
Yep, that's 10 years in a nutshell.
10 years in a nutshell, which is, interesting. But it would be interesting just to spend a bit longer on the Dragon's Den side of things, because you were right, it looked quite intense, and I don't envy you going on the show. I know Duncan Ballantyne does seem quite intimidating, but I think there were some interesting things that came out of that from my perspective. You know, one of the things that was mentioned by, I think it was Piers Linney, was that certainly he felt that at the time you were swimming against some of the trends in the industry, that you were trying to launch a print publication when very much the industry was headed in the opposite direction, in reverse, like going from print to online. So with that particular insight in mind, was he right in that conclusion, or what did you kind of decide to do from there, not just with Urban Coco Magazine, but then also the second venture of House of Coco?
What did you I felt about? Like, just because everybody's doing something, it doesn't mean that it's right. And at that time, everybody was reducing their print runs and going more digital. And I felt like, well, that's a massive opportunity. If less people are doing it, there's more opportunity for us to stand out. And I was right. You know, for 10 years, we printed our print magazine. Initially, we were just in London, then we launched nationwide, then we had subscribers all over the world. And we continued to print the magazine every single quarter for 10 years up until the year before last. So they were wrong. And we very much did invest a lot of time and effort into our digital magazine and our website and online and socials and things like that. That was kind of like the water, the content that you need every day. And the magazine was like the champagne. It was the treat. And the reason that I personally wanted to keep the print magazine is because it made me and the team feel like we had something tangible for our efforts. Whereas when you're working with content online, there's no end. Yeah, you can get more traffic. Yeah, you can get more clicks, but this kind of never ends. Whereas a print magazine almost felt like our quarterly celebration of this is why we're doing what we're doing. And brands love to see their names inside the beautiful glossy pages.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point, Laura, because I think in your defense, what you'd said to him more or less was that print was becoming scarcer at the time. So because of that, there'd be a bit more of a commodity on a really good print product. And did you kind of see that in your time with House of Coco?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it grew year on year. And it was kind of the thing that I was most proud of out of everything that we've achieved. It's a beautiful magazine. And there are people who have collected every single issue. And there are businesses that have it, you know, proudly on their shelves, and that's something that will live on forever. There's just so much noise in the online world now that print magazine was our opportunity to stand out. And also, I'm a massive advocate of having me time, and there's nothing more me time than getting a print magazine and sitting with a cup of tea and forgetting about the world around you. So kind of the audience that we were reaching really loved it.
What did the readership numbers look like before your exit, both print and online?
Online, we were reaching like 1.9 million readers a month. The print issue, I think by the end, was 750,000 readership. We were printed, we were on Readly, we had our subscribers.
Is that monthly, sorry, on print?
Quarterly on the print.
Yep.
And then also we had our own app, so you could download the print issue in the App Store as well.
Yeah, that's quite a climb from where you were, I think, when you went on Dragon's Den.
Oh, God, yeah, it's 12 years later.
Yeah, because Deborah was pressing you on the numbers of this, I remember, yeah. And you sort of squeaked out, you know, 8,000.
I don't know what I was talking about.
But you've grown it at least considerably since then.
Oh, yeah.
So you stuck to your guns. You managed to scale this. And I just wonder how you did that.
Just through the main thing was my team. So collectively, I had a team called Team Coco. And so for the last 10 years, I had somebody on a press trip representing the brand every single week in a different country, on a different continent. And that word of mouth worked so much better than any other form of marketing. Because I had someone, for example, one of the girls was in Canada, and then she was telling people about House of Coco over there. And then it sort of had this wildfire effect where even if we deleted social media, we still had this kind of self-sufficient brand, which obviously is the thing that I sold in the end, which was mainly the website.
You physically went out to other countries as a marketing tool, because when you were going over the numbers before, you were going to spend quite a lot of your 100,000 on marketing. It was like 60,000. But instead, you physically sent people out to countries to spread the word.
Yeah. Also, whatever was said in Dragon's Den, like I was 25 years old. It was my first business. It was my second business. I was young. I didn't know anything about anything. You know, I've been making this up as I go along.
I'm trying to demonstrate the learning curve rather than keeping you accountable at this point.
Yeah.
And I just am very curious how you reevaluated the marketing strategy here to instead go physically on foot, word of mouth. What was the thought process there?
Well, it would be because the initial vision for the business was that I just wanted me and the team to have amazing life experiences so that it would inspire other people to do the same thing. Yeah. And so when I got the first invitation to go on a press trip, I didn't even know what a press trip was. I was like, oh my God, how cool that I can have someone representing my magazine in Turkey. Why not? And then it just grew and grew and grew. And we were just inundated with endless opportunities for the team to travel. And there would be people all over the world every single week for, you know, 52 weeks of the year for the last 10 years. And that word of mouth, kind of, it's almost like they went and put a little House of Coco flag in every single hotel and every single destination around the world. And that just ended up having such a knock-on effect to our online reach and our readership. Hungry writers who are, some of them, still in the business to this day, and a lot of them who are full-time in the magazine now, and also some of them who, you know, been a part of this, open doors for them that they wouldn't have ever entered before.
Interesting. You can pay people with all-inclusive cruises and trips to Turkey, as it turns out.
Yes. I don't know if you can so much these days, but you definitely could back in the day. You know, I was younger. It was fun. It was like a vision that I had, that I could have this magazine, and people, you know, bought into the vision, and they were excited and they wanted to travel. We all just wanted to see the world. We just wanted to travel, and we just wanted to inspire other people to do the same.
Just a quick one from me, and then we'll get back to the chat with Laura. Save the date for our next digital journalism conference, News Rewired, on the 13th of May at News UK in London. This is a fantastic opportunity to network with your peers in the news industry and stay on top of the latest trends like scaling audience-first business models. For an extra day of exclusive access and training, join our study tour the day after on the 14th of May, where you will visit some of the top newsrooms in the UK capital. More details on that to come soon. Book tickets for the study tour and the conference and save yourself £50. All those details can be found on newsrewired.com. Right, let's get back to the chat. Okay, so you've got these writers all around the world writing about these countries, but then there comes the question, what are they writing about? Because Peter Jones did not pull his punches on this point. He very much said the quality of the product and the content was substandard. So did you take that on board? And from that perspective, what did you focus your content on to be of sufficient quality that people would be prepared to pay for?
Well, this is where the producers actually sold me down the river a little bit. So the magazine that I took into the den was not the actual magazine that was going out to be distributed. So because I told them, like, the magazine's not ready, we haven't got the first issue, like, what do I do? They said, just put anything together, just bring something so you've got a physical product to show them and we can explain, like, don't worry, this is just a prototype. And so what I took into the den wasn't even anything that ever went out into the world. It was just kind of a placeholder ultimately, which is what I thought was the truth, is what they told me. And so what Peter Jones saw, I actually saw again for the first time in, you know, 12 years, because my dad, bless him, he saved every single copy of every single thing I've ever produced. And I stumbled across that magazine that went into the den, and I am probably never been more embarrassed to be me. It was terrible, even though it was just like a placeholder and it should have been better. So what they said and what they saw was not even a representation of what actually went out into the world. And it got better and better as the years went on.
I hear you. That's fair enough. It doesn't truly represent where you are in your journey. But I think the question remains, what is the content that you focused on writing about when you did get these writers to different corners of the world?
One of the things that I loved the most was, yes, you can go to a beautiful 5-star hotel, but when you've seen one, you've kind of seen them all. It was more about who are the faces behind the places, you know, who's the guy on concierge, where's he from, what's his backstory. And there was a beautiful hotel that I stayed at in the Cotswolds years ago, and the woman who served me at breakfast, she was just so kind and just so lovely. She was like the heart and soul of the place. So we started to kind of profile and feature more, not just like come and stay in this beautiful hotel, but it was more about, like, you know, Catherine, who worked on reception, who had come over here from Iraq, and what was her story. And we just tried to make it more about the people as opposed to just the destinations.
How much of that was provided for you in these press trips? How much of it had to be sourced, like, originally there and then?
It was a bit of both, really. With the press trips, we, over time, once you start kind of learning a bit more about the industry, we were much more specific about what we needed to cover, and we would do less group trips and more kind of curated to align with what our content calendar was. So, you know, sometimes you might have Dubai wanting to do a press trip, but then you're just going and staying in all these 5-star hotels and seeing all the things that everyone's seen. So it's like making sure we can really drill down and create a story that's unique and different and not just about everything that everyone's already seen before. But these are all things that you learn over time. You know, in the beginning, when I first started, you very much feel like, oh wow, this is so cool, we're going on a press trip, we'll just say yes to everything. And then when you kind of realize, wait, you know, this doesn't align with our content calendar, where does this fit within the keyword strategy? And we'd then make sure that we were only, I think everyone who listens to this will know, in this industry, back in the day, we were all writing things because it was what we loved. But then over time, you get caught up in the constant need to hit certain targets and generate certain revenue. And so it became less about everyone just going on press trips having fun and more about, let's make sure we're only creating content that we know is working. So those people that were involved in the early days were the lucky ones, because I was learning too. So we were all just having a lot of fun. But, you know, business, isn't it, at the end of the day?
Where else was revenue coming in for the business besides the price of the editions?
So the print magazine, the print advertisers, the online advertisers, people who were buying advertorials. But our main kind of money was coming through sponsored content. And so that ended up being an entire division within itself, because the website domain authority had grown quite high. And so we were attracting orders from agencies all over the world who wanted to place content on our site every single day. So this was something that started quite early on in the first sort of couple of years, where people would say, you know, can I feature an article on your website? And in the beginning, when you need content, you're kind of like, yeah, I'll share it for free. And then one day somebody had emailed to ask if they could place a piece of content on the site, and they said they had $50. And that's when I was like, wait a minute, people are paying for this? So, you know, you've got to remember, I was new to this. I was, you know, in my early 20s, I was learning. That's when I learned about sponsored content. That's when I learned about backlink strategies. And so those $50 grew to $200, to $300, to hundreds of orders every single day. And then I outsourced that to a team in India about 2.5 years ago. And so the whole sponsored content division became a really self-sufficient, scalable machine. And that was where the kind of main asset, what I sold, which was the website, when totally self-sufficient. I was working with this team in India who had experience with scaling content sites, so that was their kind of their bread and butter. And so they took on the site and they'd grown the revenue by like 40% in the first year, and the traffic and everything like that. So
yeah, that's a funny old market though, isn't it, really? Because a lot of the people who reach out for those kind of opportunities, some of them can be spam, some of them could be, you know, not great in quality that you might be trying to maintain on the site. So was that a weeding process for you as well?
Yeah, definitely. There was there was a few things, like we definitely don't accept content that's things like, you know, gambling or sex and drugs and things like that. We don't accept AI. They use an AI checker. And also just making sure all the content that is accepted is relevant and is going to work towards the kind of bigger plan, which is to keep growing the website. So there was like an entire team there that managed the whole process and made sure that each piece of content was relevant and well written. And so yeah, it was just like a self-sufficient machine.
Let's come back to Dragon's Den for a moment. Sorry.
I'm triggered.
one last point on it, because, you know, I've watched enough Dragon's Den to know that there's a bit of a dance when it comes to the valuation when you come into the den. You know, normally the business owner comes in and says, look, my business is worth this based on, I think, the potential that it has to grow and to scale. And the dragon normally says, well, it's not worth that now, so I'll only give you this much. And they tend to meet somewhere in the middle. At the time you asked for 100,000 for 15% of the business, at that asking price, that would have put your initial business around £700,000 in value. How close are you to, you know, you've just exited from House of Coco. How close are you to that valuation in what you've exited with?
I'm legally not allowed to say, but I've done good. I'm honestly just not allowed to say the actual figures. I've signed a lot of very intense agreements and legally binding documents, and I just wouldn't want to say something that I'm not supposed to say. But I've been set up for the rest of my life, and I've bought a house in the country, and I'm mortgage free, and I'm very happy.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Seven figures though?
Can't say. I honestly can't. I can't even imply that, you know, 6, 7, 8. I can't. But
so
my dad would be proud.
I do know though that 6 years prior to this deal, you had turned down a similar, well, not similar, but you turned down a previous offer from a newspaper group here in the UK to take over the business. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so I was randomly approached by the I newspaper, and they'd seen what I'd been doing with House of Coco, and they reached out and they said, you know, we love what you're doing. They're wanting to produce or change their weekly magazine that goes out every Saturday within the newspaper across all their newspapers nationwide. And that would have meant that House of Coco would have been the largest distributed magazine, like, pretty quickly. And I was like, this sounds great, you know, why not? So he said, why don't you come up with how you think it could work, you know, come up with a strategy and come to pitch it to us. So I had the meeting with them at the Daily Mail's offices, you know, with those massive escalators in London, and went in, and not what I was expecting. There was about 15 middle-aged men in suits, and I rocked up just off a flight from New York, straight from the airport with this green lace dress on. But my pitch, I'd learned a lot from Dragon's Den, that's for sure. I actually produced a magazine, and that was my pitch. It was like a 28-page magazine, and it was all about the history of House of Coco, the vision for the future, and how this partnership could work. And I went in and I pitched this entire magazine to them, and they were so blown away. They said it's the best pitch they've ever seen. They said that we need to implement this and work out how we can work together, and we need to move quickly. And they basically said they wanted to buy the company and then pay me to go and work for them. And I said, I really pride myself on being an independent woman who has started this with nothing, because when I get to the end of this journey, I want to be able to say to other people that if I can do it, so can they. So therefore, I'm not for sale. But how about I retain full ownership of the company and we could split the revenue and work in that way? And then they just ghosted me and I never heard from them again. I've seen them implement some of my ideas across social media. And that was the end of that. But I've sold it for more than 10 times the amount that they offered me. So I'm glad that I stayed true to myself.
How do you feel about that situation?
I feel like it was just another lesson in the journey. And I kind of look back with a lot of pride that even when I was, you know, late 20s, well, early 30s by this point, that even faced with something quite intense like that, I could still stay true to myself and like remember my worth, stay true to my vision, and I knew where I wanted to get to, and that just wasn't it. So yeah, just massive amount of pride and just grateful for all the lessons, really.
They say imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, Laura, I suppose.
Yeah.
Which,
don't get bitter, get better.
Don't get bitter. Well, I like that one more. But maybe that, you know, offsets some of that feeling that, you know, maybe it didn't work out. But then again, it led you down a road where 6 years later, you've come out on the other side of the deal better off. So,
yeah, so everything happens for a reason. I'm a massive believer in that. And I'm really grateful for the journey that I've been on. And that was part of it. So
you seem like someone that's had a lot of rejection throughout your career, right? In one form or another. Has that been hard for you? And if so, how have you dealt with it?
To be honest with you, I just see rejection as redirection. It's like, well, that wasn't supposed to happen, so maybe this was. And it's all just really has happened for a reason. But I've been very lucky that I have a really loving family. You know, my mum and dad and my brother, I've got this solid unit. They've never supported me financially. I've never asked for that. But emotionally, it doesn't matter what's going on in the outside world. I always had a safe space to come back to. And as long as we were okay, then it didn't really matter about these other things. Sadly, my dad passed away nearly 4 years ago, but had a really beautiful, happy life. And, you know, it's just business at the end of the day, isn't it? As long as I'm breathing and I'm healthy, then just kind of keep things in perspective.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Laura, and I'm sorry to hear about it.
Thank you.
Obviously, you've grown House of Coco significantly over the years. And what I would be interested to know is who would be interested in taking over a publication like that? What can you tell us about the profile of this American investor that's taken over the business?
Well, I found the whole selling process very interesting. I worked with a mergers and acquisitions company, and I obviously have to input the details of the business, the revenue, everything like that. Then they send it out to their database of potential buyers. So it's a massive mix of people all over the world. There was over 1,000 people that looked at the business. There was 100 people that expressed interest. And then there were three offers on the table. And the three offers were very, very different. There was a guy in his 60s who lived in America, who was very big on sponsored content and affiliate marketing. And he wanted to take it on specifically to turn the website into an affiliate marketing machine. Then the second one was a young girl in her 20s whose dad was going, who was a global businessman, and he was going to invest in it for his daughter, who had a journalism degree. And so she wanted to kind of step in as the editor and grow it. And then the third offer, which is the one that I accepted, was three businesswomen in America who loved travel, but also had a digital marketing background. So they were interested in what they could do with the website, and also interested in what other forms of travel could they bring into the magazine, one of them being family travel, which is something we've never done. So that was the kind of angle that they were interested in. But there's a story that led me up to choosing them as the buyers. So before my dad had passed away a few years back, I was living in this huge house by society's standards. I'd made it, but I was miserable. And I randomly said one day, you know, what would make me happy? And I had this random vision that I should move to LA. And so within 2 weeks, I'd sold everything that I owned, booked a first class flight to LA. And the 5 weeks before my flight, I moved back home to my parents' house. I applied to Soho House, West Hollywood, to be a member because I sort of could see myself being in LA at Soho House. And anyway, whilst I was waiting for the response, I was back home with my mum and dad for the 5 weeks before my flight. And that's when my dad passed away unexpected. So I never made it to LA. But then I got accepted into Soho House, West Hollywood. I had to decline the offer because obviously I was planning my dad's funeral instead. And then fast forward 3 years, I got this random epiphany in November that I should go to California. And I went to Malibu. And throughout this time, I've been having these conversations with the buyers. And these three women are based in America. And I ended up meeting them after I chose them as the buyers at Soho House in West Hollywood, because I'm also now on the committee for Soho House. So it was like all these random things that were supposed to happen a few years ago were now happening, but on a much bigger scale than I could have ever imagined. And so it felt like they were the ones to pick because they aligned with this vision that I'd had previously. Such a long-winded story, and I hope it makes sense. But
It makes sense. It's incredible how sometimes the stars align, right? And when you manifest something, it can just kind of happen for you, I guess.
And if you just like never lose sight of the vision and just know that it was given to you for a reason. And that's why I just knew what were the chances that a few years later, I would be back in America at Soho House, meeting the buyers of my company. What's even crazier is that, you know, what, less than a month after I got back, I had the trip of my lifetime. I was just so high on life. I couldn't believe I'd sold my company and met the buyers. I'm like cruising up and down the Pacific Coast Highway, my convertible Jaguar, and literally just the time of my life. And now all the places that I went to have burned down, including the mansion that I was staying in, the roads I was driving on, the restaurants that I ate in, like it's all been burnt down. So now I'm like, what? This is crazy.
If only there was a tourism publication that could cover those sorts of things, eh?
Right.
Do you remember what you said on Dragon's Den in your closing interview? Do you know when you are like the post pitching phase and they get you out of the elevator and there's that moment of reflection? Do you remember what you said?
I remember that they don't give you long enough to digest what's just happened before you do say anything.
I'm sure they just shove a camera in your face and you'll have to.
Yeah. They shove you in the room with the mops and the buckets, and they ask you how you think it went. And I probably said something along the lines of, "I'm not going to take their advice. I'm going to do it anyway."
It's more or less those lines. And I wanted to remind you about this because you said, quoting you here, "I'm not going to change. I'm going to continue down this path and prove them wrong." Words to live by.
Absolutely. Also, you know, I'm a lot older and a lot wiser, and I would probably have been a bit more grateful for their input and probably taken it as constructive criticism. But at the time, you know, you're not very good at taking criticism when you're young. So maybe I would have said something different, but I wouldn't change it for the world.
Hindsight's a wonderful thing. So Laura, the biggest question of this interview is, what are you going to do with all of your time now?
Well, I've just been having a day off. I'm just really passionate about women just remembering how powerful we are and how capable we are, and how we, all of us, not just women really, but how we've all been led to believe that. Well, I just think we've all been led to believe that we're not as powerful as we are. And so I massively want to just inspire other people to follow their dreams, to always think big and then think even bigger. I am just going to continue waking up every day and just doing whatever I feel like doing. What's chasing my joy, chasing my happiness. It's worked for the last, 15 years I've been working for myself, and it's been, best years of my life.
Well, enjoy the calm while you have it. I'm sure you'll move on to something else sooner rather than later. And when you do, you know where to find us, okay?
Yeah, thank you so much.
But this has been great. I've learned lots. And just thank you so much for all your time today, Laura. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
No, it's a pleasure. Thank you, Jacob.
My takeaway for today is this. Don't be bitter, be better. Or to put it another way, rejection is redirection. There's many different cliches here which all speak to the same point. Use setbacks to make yourself stronger. This applies to many aspects of life, careers and business, or in the case of Laura, all three. Also, I think what stands out here is that she never tried to force it. She kept saying over and over again that she ran her magazine as a means to pursue her happiness, and that led her down a path of success. Go figure. What did you learn today though? Let's continue the conversation. I'm on LinkedIn or email me on jacob@journalism.co.uk. You can check out all of our episodes on all your usual podcast platforms like Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Just search and subscribe to the journalism.co.uk podcast. But that's all we have time for this week. I've been your host, Jacob Granger. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.